It's Sam Cedar launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, April 17th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Chris Hayes of Up With Chris. Also, a roving editor of The Nation magazine. On his new book, or his soon-to-be new book, Twilight of the Elites, and more. Also today on the program, just an amazing story about a kid who found his family via Google Earth. And then another amazing story about how a guy predicted our global warming crisis over 30 years ago. With one hand, I make you happy. With the other hand, I make you sad. And speaking of sad, or happy, I should say, I can't tell you how excited I am about today for two reasons, three reasons. One, it's tax day, and I'm excited because in our arrangement at our home, Nikki does the taxes, and she got them done, and I don't have to deal with that. So I'm terribly excited about that. I'm not worried about it. I mean, hopefully she was able to finagle something that has hidden our offshore accounts in the Bermuda or Bahamas or wherever we have it. I don't even know. I have plausible deniability just in case I want to, you know, become Treasury Secretary someday or something like that. Also today, what better day to have Chris Hayes on talking about the Twilight of the Elites on the day that Atreos has announced just 30 seconds ago his wanker of the decade. And of course, if you didn't know this, you have not been following Atreos. It is Tom Friedman. Head over there, check out his entire list of wankers as we take a break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Chris Hayes. We'll be right back after this. This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Listeners of the Majority Report can get a free downloadable audiobook right now. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report for your free book. You can check out Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel, The Fate of Human Societies. You don't have to read it. You can listen to it. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report for your free book now.
I cut my fingers on the way.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to this program Chris Hayes, the host of Up With Chris mornings, Saturday and Sunday mornings on MSNBC, author of the much anticipated Twilight of the Elites, which comes out in June, but you can pre-order, and I suggest you do that right now, because I imagine they're going to have to go to a second printing, probably within days upon its release.
That's extremely kind of you, Sam. I hope your enthusiasm is broadly shared.
It certainly is by everybody who's listening, because I've been talking about this book coming out for quite some time. And I'm very excited about it. And what more appropriate day for you to come on and to just, you know, I wanted to bring you on now so I get two bites at this apple when the book comes out. But when Atreos has announced his Wanker of the Decade just moments ago. And, of course, it's very much about the elites, and it's very much about how they have twilighted and let us down.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because Atreos's blog has, I think, shaped a lot of the way I started to first think about this, because he has been so dogged in documenting, tracking, poking fun of, ridiculing, excoriating elites and elite failure. And he's someone, and I think what's so interesting and people don't know about Atreos, you know, his real name is Duncan Black, and he's got a PhD in economics, and he is someone that I think, like a lot of people, had the radicalizing experience over the past decade in which they had been conditioned by the institutions that formed them. You know, I think I'm pretty sure Duncan got his PhD from Brown University, actually, where I went to undergrad, to basically trust in the people who had ascended to the heights of the meritocratic pyramid and had the experience over the past decade of having that trust and faith repaid with betrayal, disaster, and calamity. And it's a radicalizing experience. And I think Atreos and Digby is another one who I think you had on the program yesterday, if I'm not mistaken.
Wow.
Heather is someone else, I think, who comes from that. Oh, Paul Krugman is another one. Krugman is, as you know, there's no definition of the word elite that Paul Krugman doesn't fit, right? I mean, the guy is a Nobel Prize winning economist and columnist for the New York Times and a Princeton professor. And yet what the kind of cri de coeur that has been informing his work for almost the duration of the decade is, I cannot believe that all the people in charge are screwing this up as badly as they are.
Yeah, this is something that you've been writing about for quite some time as well. And it is, I think, you know, it started, the Iraq War, I think, was probably sort of the galvanizing moments. It certainly was, I think, for Atreos. And it was, in many respects, for me, although because I think it'd be coming from a legal background of some respects, the 2000 election decided by the Supreme Court was one of those moments,
right,
for myself, where again we saw sort of the and let me quote your article in Time magazine, which was titled also Twilight of the Elites. You wrote this back a year and a half ago, 2 years ago now, where you talk about the concentration of power, the erosion of transparency and accountability. You talk about the implosion of nearly all sources of American authority. And you talk, you're prescribing and hoping that this new decade, starting in 2010, will be about reforming our institutions to reconstitute a more reliable and democratic form of authority. And then you said something which is also very interesting to me. The scholarly research shows a firm correlation between strong institutions, accountable elites, and a highly functional economies. And a week or two ago, I interviewed Darren Acemoglu.
I was wondering too. I'm going to have him on too, and I'm glad I now know how to pronounce his name.
Yes.
I don't know about you, Sam. I am terrible about this, even though I am now a professional broadcaster. I always forget to ask for pronouncers, and I have the moment of panic where I'm about to introduce someone, and the name pops up in the prompter, and I'm like, oh my God, I have no idea how to say his name.
You could spell it out phonetically to me, and 90% of the time I will mispronounce it. It's impossible. But just refer to him as Darren. he appreciates that. But the premise of his book, Why Nations Fail, is because institutions that the nations don't have institutions that are democratic or
yep.
accountable or broadly inclusive, I think is the term that he
yep.
uses. And it's interesting because how you define broadly inclusive becomes a little bit of a sticking point. In the course of my conversation with him, he referenced right around the time that we were talking about the Supreme Court case, the Affordable Care Act, the switch in time
to save nine.
To save nine. And he saw this as something that was very much contrary to the inclusiveness of that institution. He has a real problem with what FDR did. And it seems to me that what FDR did, although his tactics may not have been ones that we would want to emulate or cheer about, but in some ways, he made that institution more
accountable.
Inclusive and accountable.
Yeah. That's first of all, let me say that Why Nations Fail is awesome. And there's a guy named Ryan Lewis Cooper who works for Washington Monthly, and he has a blog called The Orbital. And he actually wrote this really, he because he works for Washington Monthly, he's already read my book because he got an early galley copy and he read a copy of Why Nations Fail. And he did a dual review of them talking about the way that they kind of complement each other. And I've been reading Why Nations Fail thinking, you know, this is a generalized theory. You know, well, this is a generalized theory undertaken by actual genuine academics with genuine expertise and knowledge who spent 15 years researching this. That is a generalized theory for elite failure, basically, the phenomenon that I'm writing about in a more specifically domestic context. But you're right. I mean, I think it gets tricky. At the level of abstraction, it's easy to say things like, let's, you know, make things accountable or more democracy or democratize our institutions or devolve power back down to, you know, local level. But then those bromides and slogans can be used in all sorts of ways that actually entrench power. Right. And one of the things I think, and this is, I don't have a way sort of out of that conundrum other than to say, you know, conflict is the essential through line and the foundational bedrock of democracy. You know, the genius of democracy is the fact that it is a way of nonviolently resolving conflict. And the conflict is inherent in the fact that in any society, there are going to be interests that are in conflict. And there are going to be subpopulations because of their cultural identity, tribal affiliations, ideological dispositions, biases and prejudices are going to come into conflict. And so democracy, you know, democracy is an amazing invention. And it when it's working, finds a way to nonviolently resolve all those conflicts. But the conflict never goes away. And I think one of the things that is a theme in Why Nations Fail, and also something I tried to get at in Twilight of the Elites, is that democracy is incredible, but it's also just inherently unstable in certain ways, right? It doesn't ever rest in some easy equilibrium, because all societies tend towards an equilibrium of concentrated power. That is the way the water flows downhill, is towards the collection and pooling of power. And so it's a constant process of vigilance. It's a constant process of agitation. It's a constant process of conflict to keep the democracy essentially afloat, to keep it up on top of the hill, to stop it from the slow and steady, disintegration and erosion of the democratic principles, because democracy and self-governance are incredibly unstable. They're very, very slight when compared to the force and the gravity of the way that oligarchic power tends to exert itself.
And you know, it's interesting because when you talk about America being after a meritocracy, dig into that a little bit, because it's clear that we have moved from a plutonomy to a plutocracy. In other words, that the concentration of wealth has fundamentally led to a concentration of power.
Yeah.
What is the sort of the failure of the meritocracy imply there?
So I think, you know, the meritocracy is a way that, you know, so there's a long history. There's long been a tension in America between our democratic commitments on the one hand, our egalitarian commitments, and the fact that the nation was founded by a bunch of pretty affluent, privileged. Oh, I don't know. I think that's me playing a video for you folks at home. There you go. Sorry about that.
No, I didn't hear it. That's fine.
Oh, you didn't. Sorry. So I think there's long been this tension, right? It goes all the way back to the founders, right? I mean, a nation, you know, for this shining example of democracy built on slavery, et cetera, et cetera. And the back and forth between our kind of egalitarian impulses and our inegalitarian impulses, our elitist impulses have produced all sorts of different ways in which an elite has been constituted and then kind of broken up. And I think the basic thesis of the book is that in the wake of the social upheavals of the 1960s, we sort of left behind the old Protestant establishment and created this new kind of way of constituting the elite, which was the meritocracy, which was by its own both institutional structure and self-avowed ideological vision, much more open, more diverse, right? Open to, you know, it shunned bias, right? And that it was going to get everyone from the poor Puerto Rican kid in the Bronx to the working class son of the West Virginia coal miner to the you know, Philadelphia suburban kid who was Jewish, who had formerly been banned by the Ivy League, that everyone was going to have this opportunity, the vaunted equal playing field, and the institutions would select the best and brightest, and we would have up at the top of this meritocratic order the best and brightest drawn from all ranks and strata of society. And that just has proved to be a completely illusory promise that is not actually verifiably the case. In fact, the core idea of the book is that the kind of fatal sin of the meritocracy is the belief that you can separate equality of outcomes from equality of opportunity, that you can tolerate higher and higher levels of inequality of outcomes, and that won't subvert equality of opportunity. And so what we've had is the meritocracy, I think, in the last 30 years has kind of imploded in on itself. Empirically, we see social mobility either maintaining or declining based on the study you see, while we see inequality accelerating and we see a process of de-democratization. We see the fact that it's easier to predict your lifelong income potential or even your SAT score by your parents' income, right?
Right.
And this has all happened under the aegis, under the sort of shared consensus vision of a meritocracy where everyone always talks about leveling the playing field, which is why we put more and more pressure on the educational system to expiate the sins of the rest of the society, right? Because we understand there's this deep contradiction between what we're saying we're going for and what the system's actually producing. And I basically, in the same way that at a certain point, I think you had to say to true believers in Marxism who wanted to tell you, no, you don't understand. True Marxism has never been implemented, right? At a certain point, you have to say, well, maybe there's actually something embedded in it theoretically that produces these bad results. I want people who think, no, the problem is we're just not living up to the ideals of the meritocracy, right? I want people who, and this includes, you know, good liberals, high achieving liberals, to think about maybe actually basing a society on a vision as manifestly inegalitarian as the meritocracy is fundamentally flawed to begin with.
Well, and part of that is because what is merit? I mean,
right.
Isn't it? I mean, we have specific cultures and we have specific groups that we're determining essentially what really constitutes merit. And so, you know, thus we get education reform, which is based upon a specific type of notion of what education is supposed to achieve.
Yep.
We get a notion of what success is in society based upon a very specific notion of accumulating things in a way that comes from a specific culture.
Yep.
And so there's something fundamentally wrong with the way that we even construct meritocracy. In fact, it's not just that the system, our system of merit doesn't work. It's that the fundamentals of the way that we develop that system are problematic.
Right. And you're right that, you know, Amartya Sen has a great essay on meritocracy where he tries to pin down just what we mean by merit. And it proves to be once you subject it to some rigorous examination, it's a very difficult concept to pin down. It very easily slides into it's just, you know, merit is what the people who are privileged have.
Right.
Right. It gets kind of reverse defined that way.
Or what they value.
Or what they value. Right. Exactly. And then that's the first part of the argument about the way this gets produced. And then the results to me are the fact that, you know, we talk a lot, and this is basically to the extent, you know, I will be frank, very frank that, you know, I think the book is an attempt to synthesize in a novel way a bunch of sort of disparate threads. But it's not like I'm saying things about inequality or democracy that have never been said before. To the extent there's a novel observation in the book or a novel core to the argument, it is the fact that to make us think about the ways inequality make the elite worse, which is not the conversation we have about inequality. The entire inequality conversation we have about inequality is about fairness on the left or just desserts on the right, right? Incentives for job creators. But there's a degree to which the more elitist a society gets, the more elitist American society gets, the worse the caliber of elites it produces. Because actually, one of the geniuses of democracy, one of the geniuses of accountability, is that it forces a kind of cognitive openness in the elites, right? When you have to deal with people, when you have to deal with all kinds of different feedback coming from different sectors of society, you produce a more stable system from an engineering perspective. And one of the dangers that we've seen play out, I mean, we've seen play out in the most grisly detail, right? And I document in chapter 7 of the book all the ways in which social distance, which is the sort of name I give to this distance between elites and non-elites, the ways that social distance produces crisis. And so to the extent that you have an increasingly cut off elite, you know, you're bound to have, say, the subprime crisis, right?
Right. I mean, this is, you know, I think Jared Diamond's Collapse talks about this idea of nations failing when you have an elite that is essentially sequestered in gated communities of the mind, as it were,
yeah,
or socially, as you're talking about. And so this is, where does this change, though, from? I mean, you know, so is your hope that some of the elite, as they are now, will read the book and say, you know, my God, we're doing this wrong. When I go to the Harvard Club today, we're going to talk about
this. Right. Well, yeah, I mean, look, I think the book is pretty frank about the fact that, like, I'm implicated in this, right? I mean, I'm not talking about some other, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, I don't. And in fact, over the course of the 2 years that the book has been in writing, right, my own status vis-a-vis the elite has gotten more and more enmeshed.
Right.
And in some ways, the book is me trying to kind of work that out, you know, emotionally, personally, psychologically. But first of all, I want people to subject the basic consensus framework of meritocracy, which I think the majority of kind of right-thinking liberals share, and not for a bad reason. I think there are really laudable aspirational parts of meritocracy that are morally appealing, right? I want people to second guess that. I want them to think about whether it really is a system that is tenable, whether the fact that we repeatedly don't live up to its ideals is just an accident of us botching the execution, or there's something actually embedded in the vision that dooms itself to failure, right? I also think in terms of change, you know, one of the things I think is interesting in terms of the formulation of the 99% versus the 1%, which I think is really brilliant, because it's actually grounded in some, a lot of empirical data, but also, you know, the top 9% of it, you know, the top 2 to 10% of society, that's a pretty powerful group of people, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is a fulcrum of change conceivable in essentially a radicalized upper middle class who feels dispossessed by the genuine plutocrats.
the fractional inequality.
Yes, exactly. And I think that there is, you know, and you see some of that. You see kind of a different strains and varietals of what you might call, you know, upper middle class mass affluent radicalization. Now, some of that can be just kind of blinkered. Some of it can be really ugly, like a lot of the Tea Party is. But it also, you know, it if you go back to the French Revolution, of course, right, it really wasn't the peasants necessarily, although the peasants were active and the urban poor were active, but the kind of driving force, and this is something that Marx identified quite aptly, right, and talked about it all was the bourgeoisie as a revolutionary class. And the reason they were the revolutionary class is because they had enough power, financial capital, social capital, wherewithal, and education to be a powerful political force and also to acutely feel their own dispossession.
I think of that guy in the Egyptian, kid, he's not a kid, but who was the Google executive.
Yeah, Wael
Ghanem, I think.
Wael Ghanem.
And he, of course, fits that bill, I think, perfectly.
Yeah, no, he's a perfect example. And that often is the case in different movements of social upheaval and revolution. Not that I think the United States needs a revolution in the sort of traditional terms we understand that word, but it does need some really deep fundamental mass reformation. And I think that there is potential there. Now, there's a whole lot of things standing in the way of that, but I think, you know, to the extent my book can play some role, I do think having people think more about the cost of inequality society-wide as opposed to just the sort of moral perception of whether it's fair or not is really important. And having people who have been produced by the meritocratic system, who have to some extent been its winners, come to question it, is also really important.
What do you think changed? I mean, if we're in the twilight of the elites, what brought us to that point?
I think there's a few answers to that. One, there's a confluence of macroeconomic, global, geopolitical, financial changes that have happened in the world, having to do with globalization, having to do with sort of neoliberal hegemony, having to do with increasing returns to technology and information manipulation, et cetera, that have kind of come together to help drive this inequality trend, which is not just limited to the U.S., but actually has been happening everywhere in the world except for Latin America, where it has been reversed. And actually, Latin America, I think, is a good way, a good counterexample to show that it doesn't have to be this way, right? So, you know, there's a bunch of sort of historically contingent roots of this. That said, you know, mostly I think that the answer is we had a period of social upheaval and a set of egalitarian movements that created a new social order that then, like all social orders, started to tend towards oligarchy. I think that is essentially just the nature of America, of human social interaction. And it goes back to the point I was saying in the beginning about democracy is inherently unstable. And there's a theorist on this who I cite in the book, who has become really central to my way of understanding a lot of this, a guy by the name of Robert Michels, who was a German sociologist, student of Max Weber, who was a radical anarcho-syndicalist socialist and then later fascist, who retired in Italy as Mussolini's favorite professor. And he wrote a book in 1911 called Political Parties. And he asked this question, which is a really profound question, and I cite it in the book and write a lot about it, where he says, you know, he's dealing with the left-wing parties of a sort of proto-democratic Germany. And he says, you know, I look at the parties on the right, and they're explicitly aristocratic and inegalitarian and oligarchic in their orientation, and that's the way their parties are organized, which makes sense. But us, the parties on the left, we're egalitarian Democrats, and yet our parties are completely hierarchical and totally oligarchic. Why is this the case? And he comes up with what he calls the iron law of oligarchy, which he basically says a tendency towards oligarchy is embedded in the very nature of organization. The famous line in the book is, who says organization says oligarchy. Mm-hmm. And there's something really profound about that, and profoundly true, I think. And the lesson is, you know, ultimately he kind of comes away with a sort of depressing nihilist lesson about it, which is that, well, since oligarchy is, inevitable anyway, I'm going to go and be a fascist. But I think there's a kind of, there's the famous Camus essay, The Myth of Sisyphus, which is about the sort of the final line of, I think, that essay is, one imagines Sisyphus happy. And the idea is that the actual process of the struggle is the thing that is sublime, is the thing that is elevated and enlivening. And I think that's true about self-governance and democracy, that there is no final resting state, and that it is rolling the rock up the hill over and over. And we just haven't rolled the rock up the hill recently.
I mean, that's basically it. There's no sort of contextual. I mean, and maybe that is the technology and moving into sort of a period of new technology breaks down the immune system, I guess, to that sort of ongoing onslaught of oligarchy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think in terms of the way, I do think there's an opportunity now, and that I do think that there is a genuine democratizing potential of technology that we have now. And that can be oversold and often is, but it also is there. I mean, I think it's very hard to look at the way, things went down in the Middle East and not say that that played a crucial role. It was maybe necessary, but certainly not sufficient for what happened there. But I guess you divide it up into things that are kind of that are contingent, that are contextual, that do have to do with the way that the economy is developed. And in some ways, to be honest, I mean, I think those sources of where we are have been pretty well documented and mined and written about. It's not that I don't think that, the attack on, say, labor unions that, was a very concerted product of a very specific political project, or the ways in which the post Bretton Woods global financial order was constructed to benefit capital. All those things are playing their role. I just think those are parts of the story that have been told.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is, I mean, the last time we went through something like this, is FDR. And, yeah. I just wonder, was FDR a fluke? In other words, have we gone past the point of no return?
No, I don't. I don't think so. And I think it's important to sort of not end up in that alley of despair, partly because,
there's no value in it.
Well, there's no value in it. And I also just think it's not actually particularly historically informed. I mean, slavery was a lot worse. Jim Crow was a lot worse. Women not having the vote was a lot worse. I mean, there have been concentrations of power that seem totally unbreakable. I mean,
but let me because it's interesting, because I don't know if you saw this Barney Frank interview. I don't want to be the guy who Atreus apparently at the end of his Wanker of the Decade post basically said we're fucked, and yeah. And I don't want to be and it's really hard to do a daily show. If that is the premise, because, right. Then you just run out of things to talk about. But Barney Frank, there was one thing that struck me in that interview. Well, there was many things. I mean, it's a great interview. But he talks about how he says that, if people on the left are too prone to do things that are emotionally satisfying and not politically useful, he said, yeah. I have a rule. If it's true of Occupy, it's true of gay rights movement. If you care deeply about a cause and you're engaged in an activity on behalf of that cause, it's great fun. It makes you feel good and warm and enthusiastic. You're probably not helping because you're out there with your friends, and political work is much tougher and harder. And he talks about how he's going to write a book about the LGBT movement and how they've had increasing success. Mm-hmm. And there seems to me that there may be a fundamental difference between social emancipation of specific groups and economic emancipation.
Yeah.
Because there, there's something zero sum here, and you're playing against people, your adversaries in wresting that power, have everything to lose, at least in their mind.
Yeah. Yeah, I do think there is a distinction. First of all, I think in a lot of cases, the two are related. I mean, social and economic emancipation certainly went hand in hand, particularly for women, I think, in the way that we think about feminism and what has happened to women in both levels of educational attainment, the narrowing of the pay gap, et cetera. So, So there's in certain cases, I think the two can't be as neatly cleaved. I mean, I think that, you know, part of what I read about in the book is that, you know, part of it has to do, I think, with the dominant ethos that people subscribe to, which is the kind of, you know, Bloomberg can get behind gay marriage because it does fit within the meritocratic ethos that the American elite broadly buys into, but he's not going to get behind a living wage.
Right. And it doesn't, you know, threaten his worldview in the same way.
Right. No. And I think that worldview is not, you know, that worldview is not set in stone. And there is, you know, we have gone through periods where there's been more or less concentrated economic power in this country. And periods where it was concentrated in a way that, you know, was even worse than we have now. There is something, you know, I guess I fundamentally have a faith in the sort of self-corrective potential of democracy. It just seems a little historically blinkered to me to think that we've reached some terminus now when, if you survey back, you know, I mean, imagine fighting for an income tax in 1890, right? I mean, that's just insane. A constitutional amendment for an income tax? I mean, that just seems like a totally impossible project. But, you know, they got it done.
Or did they?
Right. You know. Nice Ron Paul shout out there.
Yes.
You know, and I think about the activists in Tunisia or Egypt who basically, you know, woke up every day with rolling the boulder, only to get crushed by it over and over, you know, this entirely, what must have seemed a totally hopeless enterprise for so long. And then, you know, things really changed. I mean, I don't think there's anything fundamentally, to be honest, you end up at a place in these discussions where you're essentially adverting to a certain kind of faith.
Right.
You know, and I just, if I have a single faith, it's a kind of democratic faith.
Well, I appreciate you're sticking with us, and just let me, I have to ask you this, cause I did, and you mentioned it briefly. I'm curious how having a show and sort of, you know, the changes that you have experienced over the past couple of years, how has that sort of changed your perspective? Because, you know, I think, you know, for me, when I started to get more involved in this, when I started to do radio coming from sort of a more entertainment background, I was sort of shocked. And, you know, maybe it's a little bit more gradual of sort of an understanding for you. But I was sort of shocked at just sort of, I had sort of perceived there was a lot more responsibility amongst, you know, it was another aspect of my sort of realizing that the elite, and in this case, sort of the media elite, were just not really up to snuff in many respects. And I'm curious, how has it changed? How has having a show and being sort of enmeshed in that world changed your perspective on it?
You know, I have to say that I don't know how much it has changed my perspective insofar as I tend to be very focused on it. It's almost like we're this little, you know, satellite within this big constellation. So much of what we do there is just, you know, is thinking about what we do for our show and who we put on our show and how we make our show as good as our show can be. And then the other show that I have a fair amount of interaction with is Melissa's show, which, you know, I have just tremendous admiration and respect for, and Rachel's, Rachel Maddow's, which again, same feeling. And I sort of think in some ways, you know what, here's one thing I would say. There's a lot less in the way of like scary corporate censorship than I think I would have thought, you know, mm-hmm. Like we can talk about whatever we're going to talk about, really. I mean, maybe we can't, and I just haven't hit up against the boundaries yet. But my sense is, you know, if it's good television and it's responsible, you know, I mean, I don't, you know, I don't think we could get away with, nor should we be able to get away with, you know, getting on national television and saying someone's a child molester without any, like, you know. So obviously there are some boundaries, but I think for the most part, I think to the degree there's a kind of sameness that people feel about quote unquote corporate media. It's much more the product, and this is something that I've observed firsthand on Capitol Hill. It's much more the product of peer effects and kind of cultural consensus and mechanisms of production, you know, not having being short-staffed, having to produce a daily hour of content, et cetera, than it is anything more explicit than that. And this not to say that you don't get hegemony and you don't get, you know, the corporate media does, you know, define certain things as outside the bounds of polite conversation and certain things as reasonable ideas when they're not. But all that's produced by this kind of, by this very complicated set of cultural peer effects in a much more subtle way than, you know, anything that has to do with, you know, a memo from the head of the company saying, don't talk about this. Now, I think at Fox, there are memos from the head of the company saying, don't talk about this.
Of course.
And there may be in other places too. But so I think that so much of, you know, here's one thing I will say. So much of the way elites behave is conditioned by them wanting to impress their peers. Right. And so much of whether they're behaving well or not is dependent on who their peer set, who they consider their peers to be, you know? And I know that psychologically for myself, that's partly the case. Like the people that I'm friends with and respect, whose politics I respect, like I don't want, you know, I don't want Sam Cedar, for instance, to send me an email being like, dude, that was really, you know, that was really crappy, your thing on, you know, like that. And that goes through my mind. And that is a really powerful psychological impulse. And that accounts for a lot of what you see.
Right. I mean, I think that's also, I mean, it seems to me that runs in power. I mean, it's consistent with what is problematic with the elites in general, is that their peer groups are just, it sort of spirals down. It's sort of like this spiraling down. It's this feedback loop. And unfortunately there's no one in that feedback loop in many of these circles that is going to send that email.
Right. And I think that's the thing you have to be careful of, you know, is just like, I think that's the really scary thing, is you don't want to lose touch. How do you not become out of touch? How do you not become a sort of, you know, end up with this set of peers that are all out of touch themselves and only kind of, you know, and only worry about their opinion and end up in a place that's really detached and remote and clueless. And I, you know, that's a challenge to me. The great thing about reporting is that it is forcing you constantly to kind of touch ground.
Right.
You know, in a lot of ways, the way our show is constructed is kind of like live, real-time reporting. It's like, yeah, come on my show and tell me about what you've seen and what you've heard and what you know. And you know, we're trying to not fall into the trap of just booking the same people over and over again and falling into that kind of easy groove. So,
well, I got to tell you, I've told you before, I'm a huge fan of the show. I think this weekend was the first weekend I have not watched it as of yet, because I was in Disney World.
How was Disney World?
It was, it was difficult to sort of parse between my between Disney World and going with my father-in-law.
Right.
And so there was
that's a whole other hour program.
Yes, there's a lot of different factors that were sort of completely. I did notice there's a lot less Mickey Mouse, and it's all about their sort of their branding of their different characters. Which, you know, my 6-year-old daughter, when we would sit down and talk about that, she didn't seem to be bothered by it. So,
right.
The show is great, and I think you're doing, you know, I continue to enjoy it, and I also feel obligated to tell you a slight amount of guilt. I took 5 minutes of your content a week or two ago on the Commerce Clause.
Oh, yeah, I heard that. That's great.
I replayed it.
Yeah, I heard that. That's good.
I'll send NBC a check.
No, exactly. Yeah, you'll be hearing from our lawyers.
All right. Well, Chris Hayes, I can't wait for the book to come out, and we'll have you back on hopefully at that time. And thanks for taking the time.
We'll have you back on.
Well, there you go.
All right, man. It was great. Great to catch up.
All right. Appreciate it. All right, folks, we're going to take a break and head into the better half of the program, during which, in that better half of the program, we'll discuss Wanker of the Decade. You know what we should dig up? We'll talk about this during the break. But I feel like I struck one tiny blow against that Wanker of the Decade. And we will talk about that. We'll also talk about, I wanted to talk to Hayes about the Pulitzer. Well, ran out of time. It was very nice. The guy, it's not like the guy doesn't have, he filled in for Maddow last night. He's got a show on the weekend. Busy. We'll also talk about this amazing story of these climate predictions from 1981, as well as that Google Earth story. You can call us 646-257-3920 as we head into the better half of the program. You can IM me at Majority FM or any of the former IMs that I've had in the past. And folks, it is your support that keeps this show alive. I'm probably going to be facing a massive lawsuit from NBC Universal simply because Chris Hayes is a great writer, and he had a great monologue on the Commerce Clause. And now the tentacles of GE and Comcast will probably come after me. And so don't just become a member for the extra 50 minutes a day you get. Become a member to support my legal defense fund. You can become a member at majority.fm. You can also support the show by going to majority.fm/support the show. Buy your Amazon crap through our Amazon crappy link, and we get a little bit of crappy kickback. You can also buy Majority Report merchandise, donateyouraccount.com/majority FM. Give us a good review on iTunes. There's many ways in which you can support the show, all of which I would appreciate your involvement in. Tomorrow will be a pre-record. I'll be in Vegas for a Torch conference, broadcasting live from there on Thursday and Friday. See you in the better half.